Ladies and gentlemen, you are standing on the threshold of a miracle. Come with me into the great beyond.
Welcome to Now Playing's bonus movie review of Clive Barker's Lord of Illusions.
How would you like to see the world the way it really is? You must see flesh with a god's eyes.
Hosted by Stuart.
Drawn to the dark side. Over and over. Don't like that.
Not much.
Jacob.
He's just some guy who's got a nose for this shit.
Like you.
And Arnie.
He's good.
We haven't seen anything yet.
This podcast will contain detailed plot spoilers and harsh language.
If it gets inside our fucking heads, it'll drive us crazy.
Listener discretion is advised.
Are you ready for my wisdom? Here is my wisdom.
Today we're discussing Lord of Illusions, starring Scott Bakula, Kevin J. O'Connor, Famke Jensen, and Daniel Von Bargen, directed by Clive Barker. This is the Now Playing co-host who may be 95% mud and shit, Arnie.
And Stuart?
Never call me a magician. I'm strictly a podcast host. This is Jacob.
So we're covering all the Hellraiser films over on our donation feed. Nightbreed is in our book. There's really only one other Clive Barker film in existence. Yes, he wrote stories that were based on Candyman and Dread and Book of Blood and Midnight Meat Train, but Clive Barker has only helmed three films. This was the third.
In fact, this was the one. Let's just call it what it is. Hellraiser was what he had to make until he could get the clout to make Lord of Illusions. This is his magnum opus. This is the film he most wanted to make. And after making it, I think he decided he didn't want to make any more.
He has referred to directing as a very expensive hobby. He has been announced, or he announced himself as the director of the Hellraiser reboot. That was 3 years ago, and there's still no cast or anything for it. But yeah, this could be seen as the end of his directing. I remember when this movie came out in August of 95, I was still at home for summer vacation before going back to college. My senior year was about to start. I was very excited. I specifically remember sitting out in a nice summer day. I reread the short story, which I had in the paperback collection Cabal over in the UK. It was in Books of Blood, Volume 6, but here they put it with the novella Cabal and three other Books of Blood stories. And I reread the story. I'm like, how the fuck are they going to make a movie out of this? And I went to see the movie opening day.
You know, I love horror noir. It's a sweet spot for mine. So it was hitting me where I live. I wanted to see it. But at this point, I lived in Chicago, which has a much healthier art film market. There's always 30 or 40 films playing. I didn't get to this. There were other things I wanted to see more. And so I didn't catch up with it until I saw it on video. And I figured Arnie and I would watch it. But I don't think we did. I actually think that when I saw this, I had rented it alone.
No, I don't think we've ever watched it together.
Yeah, and I've never seen this one, had never heard of it before we had to do it for this review. I gotta say, though, I saw Scott Bakula's name. I like him in Quantum Leap. That gave me something to hope for.
I like Scott Bakula in everything.
What else has he done? He did some Star Trek thing. I know that.
He was awesome in Star Trek Enterprise. I mean, there are shitty, shitty movies that I really love because of him, including Major League 3, Back to the Minors.
I knew you were going to do it.
Wow, he shows up in 3?
I knew that was going to be your endorsement.
And Necessary Roughness, which is a Major League ripoff with football players. I made Marjorie watch that just because I like it so much, with Scott Bakula in it.
Because of him, though.
Yeah, because of him. Although that movie actually has some other things going on. But yeah, Sinbad ain't the reason to watch that movie. It's Bakula. I loved Bakula on Murphy Brown. I will watch anything with Bakula, but I will state, I think he's always playing Scott Bakula. I think even in Quantum Leap, where he was playing a black woman, it was Scott Bakula over-exaggerating certain things. He played women, he played
men. Yeah, I saw when he was mentally challenged.
Yeah. I think what I liked about Dr. Sam Beckett was Scott Bakula. And so I will state right now, I like him in this film. I like him in every film I've seen him in.
I bet you're not watching that CBS procedural that he's doing now in New Orleans.
I don't ever watch an NCIS show.
Yeah, exactly. But he's a TV guy. What I would say is Scott Bakula has the affable personality in which he's easy to watch. And you expect him on the small screen, back when there were such clear distinctions, to be a real star. He was not made for the movies. And every time I saw him in a movie, what was that awful sex thriller he did with Bruce Willis? Color of Night? Oh, yeah, he just made some terrible movies around this time.
Oh, God, he was in that. I remember seeing that. I don't remember him in that.
Well, he thanks you for it.
But which cut of this movie did you see? Because I'll be perfectly upfront. I went and saw this in theaters, and I walked out of that theater going, I have no fucking clue what's going on. And then it came out on video, you know, about 9 months or a year later. I think I was back home already from my senior year. And it's an unrated edition, footage not seen in theaters. And so I rented it, thinking maybe this would clear things up. And I watched it, and I'm like, I still don't quite know. Finally, when I got a DVD player, out on Laserdisc came the unrated director's cut. And this was actually the cut before what came out in theaters. There's a note at the beginning, Clive Barker saying, this is the only version by which I wish to be judged. United Artists forced me to cut 20 minutes out of the film. I would only cut 11. I watched it, and finally, third cut, where they finally made it long enough, I understood what happened in this movie.
So my cut, I think I did watch the director's cut. It was 2 hours long. You're telling me 11 minutes helped this film make sense to you?
I'll say it because I rented it back in the day and had the same reaction. My one memory of this was that, it just made absolutely no sense at the end. I think it was really at the end where, like, I have no idea what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
I still feel this way. Maybe I didn't watch the director's cut, but it was 2 hours.
I saw the extended cut this time, but there was no moment where I could say, I haven't seen this before. My memory wasn't such that I could say, oh, here's the new footage.
I did listen to the commentary, and I remember listening to it back in the day. My memory of it is harsher than it was, but if I were to tell you yesterday about this commentary, it's Clive Barker being snide about stupid Americans with their MTV attention spans who are too busy eating their popcorn to follow what's on screen and don't like films that require thought.
It might not be the viewer's problem, Clive.
Yeah, I'm going to just throw that out there at the top since you threw down the gauntlet. I love a slow build. I have been accused of loving boring movies, but Clive directs too slowly. The problem is, Clive, the reason why your producers always ask you to cut things down is because you take too long to get to where you're going. And that will definitely be something true here. I understand the instinct of the studio to cut down Nightbreed and this movie. He just takes too much time.
Usually, I'm a little behind the scenes. Usually, I handwrite my notes as I'm watching, and I go about a page for every half hour. This is a 2-hour film. I only had 2 pages of notes. It is slow, and not a lot is accomplished.
I do think that 11 minutes made a difference.
You're going to have to tell me what 11 minutes they are.
Yeah, and me, I don't remember. Again, it was the movie I remembered it to be when I watched it, but I understood what happened more. So something was here that wasn't in the original viewing, but I don't know what.
Mostly, it's connective tissue. It's how he gets from point A to point B, and it's merely stating what has happened so that we can follow, because there's a lot of names, there's a lot of characters off screen, and they cut the scenes where he gets to sum it all up and bring us up to speed a second time. But then there's some connective tissue things that skip as well. But re-listening to it, he is still a little bit harsh. He says people are watching MTV, and I'm like, you know, Clive, this was 95. I don't know that MTV was showing much music anymore at that point, but this was the film he always wanted to make, and I think he was really burned, because I don't even know if he recorded that after this film was released. He was talking about test audiences who said things like, there was too much talking. There were too many words.
All right, that does sound like a dumb American audience.
And I get it. If you like Hellraiser mostly to watch hooks go into flesh, this is not going to be that follow-up. He does not deliver a horror movie by the standards you could enjoy Hellraiser or even Nightbreed. And I do feel like they go into special effects mode overdrive at the end to try and compensate for that.
This was shot in 94, a few blocks away from Hellraiser 4. It was shot for $9 million, 8-week shooting schedule. He did discuss there were some limitations. There were some trade-offs. In a couple cases, I think he made the wrong trade. But it was still medium to low budget, medium to low risk. And United Artists did want to sell this as a horror film from Clive Barker. The same mistake that was made with Nightbreed. They didn't want to sell it as noir mystery with some supernatural. They tried to sell this as a slasher, and it didn't work. It was not a big hit. It ended up budgeted at $11 million, and it made $13.
Yeah, and again, it effectively, for whatever reason, ended Clive Barker's foray into Hollywood. He just stopped making movies, stopped writing it. I mean, all the franchises came to a bitter end except for Hellraiser. But does that mean that it's an underrated gem or deservedly buried? Arnie, get into the plot. We can find out what's going on with Lord of Illusions.
13 years ago, Philip Swan, played by Kevin J. O'Connor, was a member of a cult of magicians led by Nyx, played by Daniel Von Bargen. From Nyx, Swan learned real magic, not just illusions. But Nyx had homicidal plans, so Swan and a few others, including a psychic named Quaid, staged a revolt. They knew Nyx was too powerful to be killed, so they bound him in magical items and buried him. In the years since, Nyx's most loyal subject, Butterfield, played by Barry Del Sherman, spent the time learning the magic to resurrect his master.
He did?
Yes.
Mm. I thought they just dug him up and took his mask off.
No. In fact, Harry at one point says, "Why'd you wait so long?" And he's like, "Well, I had to learn those spells to resurrect him."
And what was that character's name? Because I just called him Short Shorts the whole time.
Butterfield.
Okay.
That learned, he began hunting down the four members of the revolt to find out where Nyx was buried. And in those years, Swan amassed a fortune, selling his true magic as simple illusions and becoming the world's most famous illusionist. But one night his trick goes wrong. Swan is impaled with swords and dies in front of the audience. Scott Bakula plays Private Eye Harry D'Amore. He's a pretty standard, down-on-his-luck New York PI, sax score and all.
Oh yeah, you know it's a PI when that yeah. sax kicks in.
But he's in California following a boring case. But he's hired by Dorothea Swan, played by Famke Jensen, the wife of Philip, to look into what's going on. Harry investigates and also becomes physically involved with the now widowed Dorothea. Harry eventually uncovers the truth about Nyx, and that Swan faked his own death in front of the audience, believing that if he was thought to be dead, he and Dorothea would both be safe. That doesn't work, though, as Butterfield kidnaps Swan's manservant Valentin and tortures him until he gives up Nyx's location. Nyx is revived and the cult reforms, but Nyx kills his cultists, saying of all his students, only Swan was worthy. Swan and Harry arrives, and Harry kills Butterfield, and Nyx tries to convince Swan to join him, but when he still shows love for Dorothea, Nyx breaks Swan's body apart. Nyx is then intent on using his power to kill the entire world, but Swan uses his magic one last time to levitate Harry, who pushes Nyx into a fiery pit, finally ridding the world of the evil magician, as credits roll. That's about as simple as I could make it. That was draft 3, where I kept going through. I felt like Clive Barker, make it shorter, make it shorter.
And there are plenty of ways to do it.
Yeah, and I got a question. I mean, this opens up with some world building, I guess, which you want to turn me off. Give me a bunch of text about the worlds of magic.
That's there because of the test audiences. Test audiences said they were too confused about the difference between magic and illusions. So Barker thought it was helpful to put it up there. And he said, while Americans are getting their popcorn, to tell them what the difference is.
Yeah, it's unnecessary for sure.
So there's illusions, which are like, that's what magicians just do. That's David Blaine or whatever. And then there's magic. Is magic evil, though? It says something about demons. So I'm assuming if you know magic, you have to be a bad guy.
Well, we never find out anything about magic in this movie, so don't ask.
And then it says death is an illusion, so death is fake magic? So
yeah.
I don't even know what that means.
It means that there are supernatural forces in this world that we would call magical, and that we are going to encounter one that just has the power at the start, and we never know why he has it or why he goes evil.
I thought we were watching a Mad Max film. We go out to the Mojave Desert, and I'm guessing, you know, Charles Manson, who just passed away recently, he had a compound out in Death Valley. So I get they're trying to do something like that, but it looks very Mad Max when cars come rolling up and there's all these weird like doll heads hanging. I thought we were getting a Mad Max like magic world, which seemed kind of exciting at first.
I wasn't quite sure what to make of this originally. I've seen this film a number of times, so now I know everything that's going on. But I like the imagery of like the slaughtered chickens and the desolate. Here's what strikes me as a little bit different, especially for the time. This is not a cult you'd want to join. Normally, when I see cults, I see, you know, people in pretty sneakers, they're gardening, they look happy, they're drinking some Kool-Aid. This is led by the scuzzy, needs a shower, needs a shave, growly talking guy in a bathrobe.
Yeah, but he can back it up.
And he's just juggling fireballs, and the people are just in awe of this. I'm like, is this supposed to be real magic, or is this the illusion? Because this seems real cheap, and I don't know how you get a cult following by juggling fire.
I think that's enough, honestly. I mean, yes, if you accept...
You're ready to shave your head and commit suicide because someone juggled a fireball?
Absolutely. I mean, that's more impressive than anything Manson or Applewhite or even Jim Jones could do. I mean, yes, he can demonstrate, he can levitate, he can prove that he can do something that... That's more than an illusion. So yes, you're going to get some fans. I mean, today it would just be on Facebook. But yeah, these people have followed him into the desert. And I just want to say, I like cult movies. I mean, I'm always attracted to why people give up on society, what makes them subscribe to a certain philosophy that is counter to mainstream culture. These are things I always find interesting. I think the movie is here. I think the movie is about this cult leader. I want to know everything about Nyx. I don't want to know anything about anybody else.
I hope you're ready to be disappointed because you're not going to find anything out about him.
That is the sadness of this movie. But I feel like that he had this disciple who has turned on him is starting the story too late. We are going to see someone that he wants to bestow power to coming in with shotguns and some friends to take out this cult.
I guess let me just interject here and tell you about the short story, The Last Illusion, upon which this is based. None of this is in that short story. Nyx is not in that short story.
Wow.
It all takes place in New York City, where an illusionist named Swan has died, and he has left very strange orders that he is not to have an autopsy or anything done to his body, and his body is not to be left alone until he is cremated. And so Harry D'Amore is hired to corpse it. Well, it turns out Swan was actually a magician, not an illusionist, and he pissed off demons because he made a Faustian bargain. He got magic in exchange for his soul, but he then pissed off the demons by becoming famous with real magic. And so the demons are coming to get him so they can torment him, but if he's cremated first, he gets to escape. And so a lawyer named Butterfield, along with a horde of demons, are trying to steal the body from D'Amore and Swan's familiar, a demon Valentin, and finally have to catch him on fire.
So why do that? I mean, this is the author of that story. Why did he throw everything out about that story except the names?
I think that he had grander visions. At the time this movie came out, Harry D'Amore was kind of his recurring character. He would be in a couple of his novels, including The Great and Secret Show in Everville. He'd be in a couple short stories. It seemed like this was going to be his Jack Ryan, you know? Although he then abandoned it not too long after Everville, and we didn't see Harry D'Amore again until recently with The Scarlet Gospels. But I think he just wanted to make it feature length. And what you had there was a great episode of Tales from the Crypt. By adding Nyx and adding all this destruction, made it more cinematic.
Nix is what I like about this movie.
Yeah, and what I find confusing, because I always want to like a movie. I always want to be entertained. And again, I'm liking the aesthetic at the beginning here with this cold. I think it's silly, the juggling of fireballs, but the whole Mad Max apocalyptic world-looking type thing, I'm digging. But I don't understand what happens when Swan shows up with some other people and they're trying to save some kid. I get it. They don't want this kid sacrificed, but are they magician hunters? I don't know. I don't get any of the relationships here at the beginning. I don't feel like by the end of the film, I really get it any better.
Yeah, I want to see those relationships, but was this in the original cut?
Yes.
Because this tells everything. This is an unfortunate thing to begin here, because if you are paying attention, maybe it's because I saw it a second time, but I couldn't believe what got given away in this opening. Basically, all you need to understand is that this guy used to follow him, now thinks he's gone too far, probably because he's about to do something horrible to this little girl.
With a baboon that shows up.
Yeah.
I thought that had to be an extra scene because you never see it again. I guess in a flashback you see it, but I don't know why there's a baboon at this ritual.
Clive Barker fought for that baboon. He later on, when we see a really bad visual of a levitating car, he said, well, I could have had a better levitating car, or I could have had the baboon, and he felt the baboon was needed for atmosphere.
Why? It does nothing. I'm like, are they going to feed the kid to it? No. It growls, and you never see it again.
I'll support Clive on this. It's fun. It just gives this guy something extra, that he would keep a baboon chained around here and use it to torment this little girl. I don't know what it means, but it is something that will stick with you.
And I get that Swan knows magic. Like, we see when they're defeating Nix and putting that mask on, like, he obviously knows some kind of magic. I want to know what their backstory is, and I just don't get enough to care about Luke versus Darth Vader, more or less, here.
I get what I need here. I see that Nix is going to kill a young girl, and Swan and his others are those who've left. You know, my go-to right now would be Scientology, and what we have is Leah Remini leading her forces back to save a little girl.
I mean, I don't know if Tom Cruise is sacrificing little girls, maybe. I don't know. He might sue us now. But I want to know why they turn too good, why they stop being part of this. All these things that I want to know about them aren't in this film, that I feel would help this film, knowing motivations and characterization.
Well, Clive's a funny one. If you look at his work on a whole, a major thing that I always see are subcultures. There is always some group hidden away from mainstream society that has its own culture and customs that many would deem monstrous. And in Hellraiser, those things were the monsters. Or maybe it was Julia and Frank, but they were the things you recall. And then in Nightbreed and then some of the books, they were the heroes. Now he is back to saying, I think we're meant to understand culture evil. And that even though we don't have a lot of evidence to prove it, Nix is a bad guy for having all these people out in the desert and sacrificing chickens. A blonde-haired little girl tied up in a room is shorthand for you shouldn't trust this guy. Be on the side of the man with the shotgun coming to rescue her.
It's just a different movie. I agree with you, Stuart, that if you pay attention here, and if you can follow it later, because I think there's a real thread. The problem is, you get Swan, Kevin J. O'Connor. He's an actor who is in a ton of stuff, and I always identify him as that guy with the giant forehead because of this movie.
Yeah, what else has he done? I kept thinking it was McNichol from Ghostbusters 2.
He was in Gods and Monsters. He's in the Mummy series. He was Benny in the Mummy series, the sniveling funny guy.
Never saw it.
Yeah, he was Dr. Mindbender in G.I. Joe, The Rise of Cobra.
You gotta give me something else.
I don't know if we're gonna get anything you know, Stuart.
He was in Virtuosity the same year as this.
Oof, that's a horrible film.
Canadian Bacon.
Yeah, it's also a horrible film.
I don't remember what he's did in it. Yeah.
Okay, so I don't know him. All
okay.
Right.
Peggy Sue got married?
I mean, he is not a featured player in anything that I can recall.
Then you've got these other three cultists. One, her name is never said in this prologue. I watched it twice to find out. And two, do not look the same as when we see them again in the future.
Yeah, when we catch up with these people later, I guess those are the guys that were with Swan. I'm not sure.
It's the same actors.
Really?
I did check to see if they had young this person and old this person. They did it all through makeup. They did it a little too well.
I recognize them. I'm certainly one guy's got a snake draped around his neck. I paid attention to that.
I'm talking about the good guys, though. Swan's gang.
Yeah, that's who I'm talking about, too.
Oh, wow, that's the same guy later at the tarot?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's very confusing.
Holy Toledo. No, you're fucking me up.
No, that is the same actor.
Huh. Good makeup job.
Exactly.
Dorothea is the only one that has a young version.
She doesn't have an old version, though, does she? Oh, Dorothea. Yeah. Dorothea, not...
Dorothea, yeah. She's the main character.
I was getting confused with Maureen Pym, who we don't even know.
Yeah, the character... Many times, Clive Barker makes the decision to have more characters when less would be the right choice.
But... I don't need their backstory for why they turned evil. I just believe, hey, they don't believe in killing little girls. I can understand not believing in killing little girls. I always got something that was weird between Nix and Swan, though. Like, you got Butterfield.
The homoeroticism? Are you talking about that?
Butterfield is quite obviously feminine.
Yes, androgynous. Two different colored eyes. Maybe they're trying to evoke Bowie. I don't know what they're going for. But yes, Clive Barker clearly sees him as some kind of Pan figure, is what I kept thinking about. Something from Shakespeare's The Tempest.
He clearly wants to be Nyx's favorite. He is doing everything for Nyx. He's like, let me kill Swan. He wants to kill his rival for being star pupil. But Nyx and Swan, Nyx envisions a future with him and Swan ruling together and is willing to impart more power upon Swan. And it's an unusual dynamic where you see the really bad guy who is longing to work with the hero. It's not even, let me seduce you to the dark side. It's like, let's hang out and be buds. And I do like the effect where he's like, let me show humans for what they really are. And the way they kind of open up like bugs and you see all the goo in there.
You talking about those awful CGI effects?
Yes, he is. That doesn't seem like a revelation to me. Like, humans are really flesh that rots. I don't need jelly vision in order to get that. We know that's where we're headed. This is strange that the cult leader has built his whole premise on. You can't believe it, but you're all going to die. I know. I'm aware.
But he's offering a way to avoid that. His magic defies death.
Right. Eternal life is always a good selling point. And something about burning the world. You know, usually people that join cults, they have within them a desire already to abandon mainstream society. He says something about burning it down. So I guess quite literally, he is going to scorch the earth.
But he's taken out not by any of these people, and I do sometimes wonder why they don't pull the trigger, but the little girl in the corner.
Oh no, guns are useless in this movie. They never shoot them when they should. When Scott Bakula shows up with the gun, he never pulls that trigger when he should. Like, the whole time I'm yelling, pull the trigger, shoot the evil magic guy.
I've never thought that. You'll have to point it out as we go.
You bring a gun, start shooting it. They want to sit around and talk because they got all their gobbledygook magic stuff they gotta exposiate here, but just shoot the guy.
The little girl does. She gets hold of a pistol and she actually saves herself while all of her saviors are standing around chit-chatting. She shoots Nyx in the back and they're able to put this man in the iron mask thing on him. That's kind of cool.
Yeah, and so they say, we're going to bury him. We cut. We never know where they bury him. If the pixie guy had just kind of hung around and followed them, he would be able to dig up this body and know where it is.
Why not cut him up? Why not burn him? There's so many questions. The fact that they're just going to bury him, and I'm like, oh, so now he could come back later on in the film.
Yeah, obviously that's the whole point. They told us in the opening, I think, what they're teasing as a mystery that is going to take the detective the whole movie to figure out. This magic man's coming back from the dead. We don't want that to happen, so we've got to stop it. Got it. That's all that I need to know.
There's other mysteries inside mysteries. I do think the prologue spoils a lot. I also think if we found this out through dialogue, though, we'd be saying show, don't tell.
Yeah, that's why I ultimately don't think it should be a detective story at all. You want to talk about useless? It ain't the guns. It's Scott Bakula.
What? All right, you're talking about the main character that Barker has written about. And the actor who so personifies this character, Barker has said he can no longer write the character without picturing Bakula. And I'll be honest, when I'm reading the Scarlet Gospels, I hear Bakula's voice for all of Harry D'Amore's stuff.
Oh, I have no doubt that Clive Barker is thinking about Scott Bakula quite a lot. It's very clear from all the shirtless scenes that he's made the mistake that many straight directors do. The reason why that awful actress that shouldn't be in that part is constantly ruining the movie, they fell in love. It's very clear he's in love with Scott Bakula in this movie and keeps him around, even though it would be so much better for this movie to have an actor that actually was like Humphrey Bogart.
He only has one shirtless scene.
No, he has multiple.
Look, I really noticed that tattoo. I want to know the backstory of his tattoo in this film because I don't think Scott Bakula actually has that tattoo. It's like some magic emblem or something.
Actually, it is. If you read the later books, not in Lord of Illusion, that's one of D'Amore's first mystical stories. But by the time you get to Everville, he's green sleeved with every possible tattoo of protection and warning and things against every possible spirit.
Scott Bakula is a warm TV presence that has none of the gruff movie charisma of Sam Spade. And every time here that he's trying to swig a beer and try to seem like he's tortured because he has this relationship with the supernatural realm, that's not him. That is just not this character.
I think he looks the part with the 5 o'clock shadow. I think he plays it pretty well. I always get a world weariness from Bakula. I got it in Quantum Leap. He was stuck leaping from life to life and never going home, never getting a day off. I got it here that he's a little bit burnt out. He's a little bit unsure of what happened with this kid and the exorcism.
I am too, because they don't explain any of this. They have a newspaper lying around saying something went down in Brooklyn with an exorcism, and he has a couple flashbacks with the demon and the kid, but ultimately this is teasing some sequel that never got made.
I don't even think it's teasing a sequel. I think it's telling a backstory about when a demon spoke to him and said, "Taste the darkness." This is his arc, is he's attempting to really not live in this world of magic. He doesn't want the fact that he constantly is drawn to these cases that involve the supernatural, and he's wondering what it says about him. And they talk later on about him walking the line between heaven and hell, and the fact that this demon said, "Taste the darkness," D'Amore. Later on, he's going to hear that again in this movie. It's his arc to come to terms with his life's path of being a supernatural hero.
I think you've read the books, because I'm not getting any of that. I'm confused.
It's not in the short story. I told you what that short story was.
But he's been in other books.
All right. I don't get that in this movie. I get that they want to do something like that.
Yes.
That, he has some history with the cult, so he's going to have to confront his feelings about magic. I don't know what his feelings about magic are here, though. I just know that he dealt with an exorcism, so I don't know. Magic later on.
Yeah, and again, when I look at other people that have done this, again, I have a soft spot for this. I want to watch a detective that is communing with the supernatural and solving cases. I think that's great. He ain't no Keanu Reeves. I mean, I like Constantine more than this. Bakula is flat. He is not good in this movie. I don't know how you can say he's showing an edge.
I think he is a very good presence to carry us through this story. He is the point of view character for the majority of it, because when we return to Los Angeles, it's going to be a very different life than what we saw 13 years earlier. And he's the one who we follow scene to scene and discover what has happened in this 13 years.
And that's a hoary thing. I mean, that's what they teach you in screenwriting when you're like, I got this idea and it's hard to develop and convey. Well, then why don't you murder someone and make it a murder mystery? Or why don't you have a detective come in and they can figure out what's going on? Like, those are easy mechanics on how to solve something. But that's not what this is about. This detective doesn't grow and change and become something interesting in this thing. He will constantly be trailing that opening and won't figure out a single thing. This movie would be no different if he did not appear in it at all.
Not true. This is not Raiders of the Lost Ark. If he did not appear, Nix would kill everyone.
I feel like Swan, I mean, he is going to go away, but he's going to come back. I feel like Harry should be the new Swan. If you're going to do this whole backstory about an exorcism and he has to walk that line and he's got to embrace the magic at some point, and the movie should be about him. I don't feel like this is Harry's movie. Ultimately, it's about Swan and Nix.
Yeah, I mean, he ultimately needs to show what he does with the supernatural. Does he know voodoo? Does he have some kind of conjuring? Does he do tarot himself to solve these things? Honestly, obviously his detective work is really lazy.
He goes to LA for some insurance scam, and he only knows what the guy is up to because he left the windows open so he could watch this guy partying with some real ugly hookers.
Yeah, it takes a really long time for us to get into this movie. Why start in New York? Why not just be an LA detective? Why do we have to even involve this insurance thing? Why can't we have him hired by the Swan magician?
I do think that Barker was in love with his thought of having a New York PI. There were talks of sequels and TV series and things that we'll go to at the end. And I think setting it in New York was important for that. I also think you're mistaken when you ask, is he a magic user of any kind? Is he a fortune teller? No, he's always supposed to be the everyman sucked into supernatural occurrences. He'll hang out with people who cast spells, but that's not who he is. And he always falls into this stuff. So
it's just always happenstance? There's no relationship to the supernatural realm?
No, it's karma. It's...
Oh, God, that's awful.
Yeah, he should have some wry sense of humor. I'm imagining Harrison Ford and Indiana Jones making jokes about, you know, all this weird stuff going on.
I think Bakula embodies that wry sense of humor. I think that is what he constantly lives.
Well, you watched a very different movie. You got a different cut than I did then.
Yeah, I get that you like Scott Bakula, and I don't have anything against him, but this is miscasting to the T. This is like, yeah, I'm quantum leaping this. I'm going to just jump into this role and grow a 5 o'clock shadow and say I'm Humphrey Bogart and have none of the gravitas. None of the gravitas.
He does lack in gravitas. I'll give you that. And if you'd had more money, and I'm looking back at the time, you know who probably would have killed in this role is Bruce Willis before he went to shit.
Anybody. I mean, watch Angel Heart, which does a very similar thing, only actually has the detective story intertwined with the mysteries he's investigating. Mickey Rourke was great at this. I think many actors have an edge. Sean Penn has an edge. There's many people you could get that could credibly play a detective. Scott Bakula is a TV detective.
I think he does fine here. I really do.
You're saying more than fine, though.
I'll admit it. I wish I got to see Scott Bakula carry this character forward in other films and things. I like what he does here. But I do get... It feels like poor storytelling that he's out there for this insurance thing that never goes anywhere. It is merely a breadcrumb trail to lead him to the real mystery and never brought up again. That feels unrealistic.
It doesn't feel it. It is it, Arnie. This is terrible writing. I can't believe that this is Clive Barker's dream project and it's so badly put together. This is the writing of an amateur. I mean, I would give this a D in screenwriting 101.
Again, I think Barker is very tied to the fact that D'Amore always starts with the banal case and then stumbles into magic.
Yeah, all detectives do that. But you actually have the person they were investigating. At some point, you go back to them for some reason to make that worthwhile. Here, yes, he follows somebody from their hooker party to, oh, I'm late for my palm reader. Oh, he's dead and I'm gone for the whole movie.
I am so confused because he's partying with hookers. You're paying him by the hour, I'm assuming. And he's got to leave to get his palm read? Huh?
And that just so happens to be Nix's old turncoat cultist, the black guy with the shotgun that we saw in the opening, Quake. That is a terrible way into this story.
I was so confused by how disjointed this was when a skinhead shows up to fight D'Amore. I'm like, I don't even know if that skinhead's coming back. I don't know if he's related to the cult. It could just be a random skinhead that he ran into. Who knows?
He wasn't at the cult.
No.
There are two henchmen. We only need Butterfield. Why do we have another one?
Well, because Butterfield is quite clearly not the muscle.
No, but he has a lot of torture devices that he loves doing, and he stabbed Quaid 12 times in the chest. That's all we need here. I guess they felt like there needed to be action, so we have rolling around here for the gun and going out the window, but Clive Barker multiplies. When it should just be one henchman doing the work, suddenly there's two people.
And my big problem is that henchman, he has such a good look. He's a skinhead. He's got filed down teeth. I mean, he kind of looks like Flea gone berserk. And his name is Ray Miller. He has no cool name. Butterfield is a cooler name than Ray Miller.
Barely.
Yeah, we do see Quaid there My big problem on the first time was even knowing this was the guy from that early scene.
No, I was making assumptions at this point. I'm like, I don't know. There's a black guy at the beginning. I'm assuming this is the same guy.
I don't think we would know that Butterfield was the same guy either if he didn't have the two different colored eyes. That's the one thing, because his haircut is different. He's wearing a different style of clothing.
Yeah, they're still real tight, though.
For some reason, they changed that actor and they changed nobody else.
Oh, weird.
What? So there's a young Butterfield and an old Butterfield?
Yeah.
Oh my.
Yeah.
That's the only character I could keep track of.
Again, bad directing choices here.
Young Butterfield was in Return of the Living Dead 3. He was the star.
Wow. Quaid is going to read D'Amore's hand like his future is somehow entwined with this plot.
He turns over the Ten of Swords and he kind of looks like it with all those knives in him.
And tells him the Puritan is coming.
Yeah, why? Again, with extra characters, now they're given multiple names. Are they trying to hide the fact that this is Nix? Because I didn't even get Nick's name at the beginning.
No, because in the opener, he said, I'm the Puritan. He said that in his monologue holding a fireball. I mean, this couldn't be more spelled out if you're catching all the details.
Yeah, I did not catch that at the beginning.
The reason why it will be confusing is these details are strung out very badly by a poor storyteller.
And admittedly, in the shorter cut, some of those details just are cut. Some of them just are not there. But in this one, I think that the story is progressing logically to a point, because the moment D'Amore is at this supernatural killing, he does what smart people do and calls the cops. Hey, there's been a murder. Hey, I threw a guy out the window. Ray gets up and has disappeared. And we see two new people, Dorothea and Valentin. They see D'Amore in the newspaper, having been around Quaid. They know about D'Amore because of the exorcism in Brooklyn. And so they decide to hire him to find Quaid's murderer.
Okay, so to be clear, D'Amore was working in an exorcism case, was hired to go to LA to work some other case that doesn't matter, and now makes the papers there so he can be hired for another case. What's he being hired for now?
He's being hired to investigate Quaid's murder because Quaid and Swan go back a ways and Swan is acting weird, and Dorothea wants to be sure her husband is safe, and so wants to know who's the people behind Quaid's death.
I thought he was being hired as a protector for the husband. Even though he's being hired to find out who killed this fortune teller that Philip saw regularly? I mean, did it ever establish that he got his fortune read there? He says that he trusts the cards. Did Quaid read his cards?
I don't think that they were close ever since the whole cult thing, but they had history.
Speaking of all these characters and the relationship, Valentin, is he just, I wrote him down as just Swan's manservant. He wasn't part of that rescue mission at the beginning. He's just a new character here that's really concerned about getting that awful painting of Swan straight.
Yes, he is their, they already have a guy that can do everything. They should tell him to go investigate this, but they're going to hire Harry, someone they don't even know, but because he was in a newspaper, hey, why not?
Get an actual private eye instead of your butler to do detecting.
He's not just your butler. He knows where you buried the bodies. Literally.
But he wasn't with the original cult?
No. He knows all their secrets.
Oh, this is very confusing.
He would even know this is Quaid and you know that it's Butterfield trying to kill you. You know all this. It's not a mystery to you. You were there.
But it is a mystery to Dorothea because they keep her in the dark.
Why doesn't she not know? She looked like she was 12.
All right, so this is one of the big shocks, is it's revealed she was the little girl from the beginning. We're not supposed to know that for a long time.
Yeah, because she went from a blonde to a jet black woman.
Yes, that's the only way that they can disguise this, is making the choice that she looks nothing like she did when she was 12.
Right, and she's gone from a 12-year-old to Famke Janssen, Phoenix.
Terrible actress as well, giving another flat. Is this a femme fatale? I mean, this man needs a course in film noir. I'd love to sit him down and show him some 40s detective stories so that he could properly copy them.
She is pretty ineffectual as that goes. I mean, yes, I've seen films like Body Heat and things. She does not have any menace to her ever.
Mm-mm. Opposite of Body Heat. And you can tell Clive's not into her. I mean, she's in onesies and during the sex scene, it is all Bacula and she's under a sheet.
We get to see a little bit of Phoenix Nip.
Barely.
It is. I thought we were going to get some full frontal from Bacula at one point.
If you think this movie is about ogling women, I don't know where you would see it.
No, it is not about ogling women. I'll agree with that. But she's the one who hires D'Amore. She is out of the loop. She doesn't know. Valentin doesn't want Damore around. He's just doing this because she says to, and he's humoring her.
And who cares? You're the fucking butler. Who cares what you want?
But to introduce Damore into Swan's life, Swan, the famous illusionist.
Yeah, because you're supposed to be investigating this murder, why don't you come to the Pantages tonight? What?
Well, yeah, you got to really understand his methods, know his show.
No, I don't. I have to investigate who killed this man on the other side of town. And by the way, you know who did it.
But he doesn't know why or even who they are.
He knows good enough to fake his own death and disappear.
Oh, Swan does.
Yes!
Swan doesn't know specifically who it is.
Then he's an idiot.
Yeah, he is a dumb ass that deserves to get speared for real.
Hey, if I was Harry and a beautiful woman asked me to go to an expensive show I couldn't get into usually, I'd go. I mean, it's almost like if I was in New York to cover Toy Fair and I got hired for something much cooler while I was in New York, and then ScarJo said, let's go see Hamilton. Yeah, I'll go see Hamilton.
This is ScarJo? I mean, I know that Famke was on the top in GoldenEye around this time, but she's got no sex appeal in this, and they have no chemistry together. I mean, I honestly don't see that he thought that this was an opportunity to go with a beautiful woman anywhere. I think that he is walking through this part. But I will say this. I loved magic when I was a kid. I studied it. I had the Blackstone kits. And when I had the opportunity to go see David Copperfield on stage at the Sangamon Center here in Springfield, it is one of my cherished memories. This was fun. To go to a cheesy, solid gold kind of 80s style magic show, what a great send up. I don't know if they're trying to be funny, but I was laughing a lot watching his stage show.
I don't think they were trying to be funny.
He does some real Cirque de Soleil shit here with like topless dancers. And the fact, I guess they got to reestablish that Swan does real magic. Is he going to levitate for like the stagehands for no reason?
Well, he's preparing for the show and the stagehands think it's an illusion. And I'll agree with you, Stuart. I also had magic kits as a kid. I was never very good at it. I also saw Copperfield here in town, but not at the same show. I think it was years after you. And I always felt so disillusioned because he made a group of 20 audience members teleport to the balcony. I was sitting in the balcony, so I saw them all come up the fire escape. Oh. So.
Yeah, I did know someone that worked for him. Years later, I learned some of the secrets, like how the Statue of Liberty went away.
Yeah, I've heard that one.
I'm not going to spoil it. He probably shouldn't as well. But again, it's getting me back into this movie to have this moment. And anytime this movie can get towards the occult and getting the idea that Harry Damore, who I thought had some kind of connection to the cult other than bad timing and walking in at the wrong time.
He trips into it every now and then.
What a bad choice that is.
I actually think there's something about a character who doesn't want to face the dark and is fated to, you know, just when I thought it was out, they pull me back in. I kind of like that.
Yeah, it would have been cool if they would have made that movie. It's not here.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe it's because it's the second time, but I think it's set up pretty obviously. The reason why he has the new illusion that is going to quote unquote backfire is because he is afraid of being killed and wants to disappear. Let's just follow this character, Philip Swan. He's introduced, you know, in modern day LA, reading the paper about his friend's death. We remember that they went into this cult. They know that Nyx is coming back. So yeah, he's going to fake his own death to go hide.
Now, when I first saw this movie, I was really confused later on when Swan returned. But I had no thought that this was a fake. I thought somebody had altered his trick and he was murdered.
No, I thought they really killed him. Yeah, you see a shot of Butterfield and the skinhead at one point. So I'm like, oh, they must have messed with it. They're going to show up backstage later on. Because I thought this was Scott Bakula's film. It's not really his film, though. But I thought they're clearing the stage so he could be the new magic user.
Yeah, I mean, it would make sense for a detective to investigate a murder. But what he was set up to do was to find Nyx. And so we're just waiting for that to happen. I had seen this movie before, so I can't say, oh, I saw it coming. Maybe I remembered it that way, but it seemed pretty obvious. To me, it seemed like, wow, okay, obviously he's not dead.
No, it completely fooled me first time that he survived this. And it may be because I just read the short story where it's about his actual corpse being protected, but I did not foresee this being the illusion. And I think that's perfect. That's exactly what this should be, is they pulled a trick on us that this is an illusion.
Oh, Artie, come on. I got to call you out. You got mad at The Prestige for cheating. This is a cheat because we're going to find out there was a dummy, right? That it was a fake body. But we see that body moving around, dodging a few of those swords.
No, only in the coffin was it a fake body. This is a real person on stage.
So he was doing his real magic and avoiding death somehow. Okay.
Here's the cheat is that, all right, so Harry DeMore is going to get up there and see something electrical underneath the spinning thing. He never actually figures out how this guy got away with it. I thought that he was going to sniff something out. If you're looking for Scott Bakula to figure out, you're going to be waiting all movie long.
We'll get to that. I still think he does discover stuff.
He does not figure out how Philip cheated death. And in fact, Philip never reveals that to us because by the time we get back to Philip, we don't even give a fuck how he did it.
Stuart, he has real magic.
That's how they do it?
That's what I just asked.
Yeah, you can't complain about Prestige then.
But we know he has real magic. Unlike The Prestige, I mean, we start this movie with real magic. Unlike The Prestige, which is like, we're going to play by real world rules. Fooled you, there's a cloning machine. That's bullshit. But I think there's one cheat in this movie that I just can't abide is, obviously, when Quaid turns over the card, the Ten of Swords. You know, I used to do tarot readings. I know what my cards are.
I was impressed it wasn't the death card. That is 99% of the time tarot decks are in a horror movie. They turn over the death card, so props on them.
But here, they're redoing the Ten of Swords, but only 9 swords fall.
Well, fuck this movie. It's garbage.
I think that maybe in some shots there might be 10 swords in him, but only 9 swords fall, and that spiral's impossible to count. But damn it, they should have had 10 swords fall.
We're supposed to think because they stabbed Quaid 10 times that they also stabbed Philip 10 times, except then in the very next scene, we see Butterfield asking Harry who killed him.
And Harry believes Butterfield did.
But why would Butterfield be asking and chasing around? If he did it, we would know it as the audience. We would know from his reaction.
And if Harry knew who it was, he probably wouldn't say to Butterfield, you did it. But Butterfield's still going to torture him for an answer until Harry smartly punches him in the balls and then kills poor Ray. And I've always loved that Ray is stabbed through with the sand machine. And so it's blood and red sand pouring out.
So is Ray, he can't cheat death because he got thrown out that window at the fortune tellers and then the body's gone. I thought because he was a cult member, they couldn't kill him, but he's dead here.
Was he in the original cult? I don't think he was.
Well, I don't know. He joined later. The point is he got thrown out a window and then walked away, but this kills him.
The point is, I don't care about this henchman. I want to know what Butterfield's going to do. And Butterfield is eventually going to do the thing he should have done years ago and ask the valet, but it'll take most of the movie for him to do it.
I mean, I think my favorite part comes next because, oh, I'm a cool, smart detective investigating magician. So what am I going to do out here in LA to solve this case? Go to the fucking Magic Castle. Like, this is a real thing. This is a very exclusive club. You got to be invited. Strict dress code. Man, Harry does not follow the rules.
Jacob, I gotta break your heart because I know it was sold to me that way as well.
Oh, is it not really like that?
I have been there. And yes, this is the marketing. The marketing is you have to know magic to get in or know someone that does and blah, 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 blah. The Magic Castle is a magic school that outreaches to corporations. And so a lot of people that work in companies as a way of wining and dining clients will get invites that they pass out. And so I, because I knew someone, got in. It is not unlike many theme restaurants, honestly. The food is bad. The atmosphere is adorable.
It's a medieval times is what you're telling me. That breaks my heart.
It is absolutely medieval times. And the magic you see, it's room after room of beginner magicians, some better than others, doing the same tricks, though. I gotta say, I was disappointed, even though I love the idea. And it may be better now that I know it's under new management. I know Neil Patrick Harris now runs the thing. He's really into magic, but that was after the making of this movie. They are really in the place. When they're in there, that's not sets. That is really, you don't have to have the exclusive invite to get in there. They really shot in the Magic Castle, but it's not as cool as I hoped.
Yeah, well, if they're letting Scott Bakula in.
God damn, guys. I'll say one of the big things that was cut in the shorter edit was Scott Bakula meeting the old magician in the main area and just the establishing shots of the magic castle, it literally jumped from the scene of Swan's death to Harry drinking with Vincent Schiavelli, who plays Vinovich.
That cracked me up that he shows up as a magician.
Yeah, there was nothing with Walter in the shorter cut. I'm like, how the hell did he get there?
That's crazy. They don't show that they're in the magic.
No, they don't show that he's just suddenly in this dinner.
Like, they don't tell you, oh, this is the magic castle where magicians hang out. Like, that's a really important thing to establish.
Yes, it is.
Or not. I mean, I would make the case you could actually, if you're trying to find 12 minutes to shave off, you could cut everything here. I mean, they learn nothing here. I mean, all of this will be an elaborate thing. There's two magicians to get to the one that will help him break in later through a skylight to get some files that we never find the contents of.
They don't even use magic to break in, which was really disappointing.
Well, I do like Vincent Schiavelli's performance here. Schiavelli, you know, he's a character actor, ghost, Better Off Dead, tons and tons of stuff. And I love it when he breaks into the Brooklyn accent at the end. It's one of my favorite scenes.
Oh, it's a, okay. See, I'm like, why is this here? This character absolutely does nothing.
But it's introducing him to Billy who is
exactly.
Who?
We don't need a Billy Who, but it does introduce him.
This is played by Lauren Stewart, who is not an actor. He is actually a magician in LA, and he was the magic consultant to Clive Barker and how they were able to get into the magic castle to film. And Billy Who is going to lead Harry to find out about Nyx.
And that's terrible. I mean, again, this detective does nothing. I would think so much more of him if he could figure out his own way into this secret repository that allegedly has all of, you know, mankind's secrets, but is of course just filled with Ripley's Believe It or Not junk. And supposedly it has a file on Nyx where we can find out how he got his powers, but we never will.
It's got the file that describes his powers and says there is real magic, which is hidden. And Harry makes contacts to someone who is going to know where the secret room is and its secrets. I think that is smart that he doesn't just break in alone.
I think that getting the magic castle in here is a really inspired idea. This movie is lovingly using LA. I'm missing it around this time. I love every time they go to a location that I know. I mean, the fortune teller was in Venice, and yeah, this is right there in Hollywood. It's fun to see, but you need to have a script that justifies it. And all of this shenanigans to get to Billy Who and a bunch of files that don't mean a goddamn thing is a waste of time.
I think this is Harry being a proactive detective. I do like the atmosphere of the Magic Castle. I like Billy Who. He's not an actor, but I think he plays one just fine in this movie. I wish he did a little bit more, because after they break in, he doesn't really come into it. I really love the security feature of the Magic Castle with that hologram from like a Roger Corman 50s film.
You love that. See, these are things that I'm like, yeah, why don't we cut this? Again, if you're looking for 12 minutes out of your 2-hour movie,
cut the Scooby-Doo shit.
Here's plenty of examples to do that and not lose plot details.
I have a feeling United Artists wouldn't allow them to cut anything with a monster because they wanted to sell it in a horror movie.
MTV generation, they need their action.
And this was heavily used in the marketing, this brain hologram creature. Not that I understand why, because it isn't great looking. It's perfect, though, as a hokey defense mechanism. But no, I think this gives it some character. And then Harry does more digging. He's heard of Jennifer Desiderio. He goes back to Quaid's fortune-telling shop in Venice, I guess, and gets her address of the mental institution.
Yeah, I want to just underline how stupid that is, that what you just said. He walks back into the crime scene, finds a secret place where he keeps his address book, because why would he need to hide who he knows? And yes, this name that someone happened to mention once, that we don't even know who it is from our own experience of watching the prologue, but it is the brunette that came in there with the shotgun. He went and visited her once at the asylum.
No, regularly. He was a regular visitor and her only visitor.
Okay. Yeah, her only visitor for the last 4 years.
And this is my big problem. A detective story, they're interesting because they should be smarter than you. They're picking up those clues. They're finding the leads. Harry goes to a magic restaurant to talk to magicians because he's on a magic case, and then he finds an address book. This is just not interesting detective work.
Yeah, I really want to underline how badly Clive has written this. I mean, for a novelist, this is your bread and butter. I'll give you, you're a director novice, but this script, the dream project, should be airtight, and it is embarrassingly bad. It's what's killing my fun here, because again, I love what he loves. I love the mood and the atmosphere of LA and noir paired with this occult theme and the idea that this monster is going to come back to life. I think Nick sounds scary. I wish we could be investigating that and not all of this stupid shenanigans.
I mean, around this time when they go to the sanatorium, we do get this cool montage of, I guess, the cult members, they're being reinvigorated because they know maybe, or there's a sense that Nyx is coming back and they're killing people. I like that stuff.
I think Butterfield sent them letters because we do see some envelopes. And this entire thing of the cult members, cut from the shorter cut. This is literally my favorite scene of the movie.
Yeah, it is the best part of this film. It's the only stuff I liked.
Again, I would love to know more about this cult. I would make the argument, actually, that if you got rid of this being a detective thing and finding out retroactively and just followed it as a story about a magician who apprenticed with a cultist and then broke away, you would have had something that would have been really unique. But you need a different framework than what we have here. Finding out in this way that, yeah, that woman from the prologue is now in a sanitarium or Huntington Gardens, I think it actually is.
Yeah.
And that she's going to be so scared of people digging a grave that she's going to run in front of a car.
I think they were like construction workers. They weren't really digging a grave.
Yeah.
They were digging like for pipes.
Yeah, but she's so mentally addled about the guy coming back from the dead that that is enough to trigger her to run straight in front of a car and die. I mean, this is just almost laughable at this point.
It does seem like there's some really bad care at that hospital, especially since the nun is like restraining Harry while Jennifer runs out in front of a car. And I kind of like that wherever Harry goes, he kills people. I mean, everywhere he goes, somebody is dying. His investigation is clearly lethal.
Oh, okay. I guess you could look at it that way. I mean, I suppose there is a story there if it were framed right. But again, he's so passive. He's just walking around while the story unfolds around him.
But he's actively investigating and discovering information that even wasn't conveyed during that prologue. We do not know that Butterfield is resurrecting Nyx until Harry finds out.
Really? We don't? Because I feel like that's obvious. I'm just trying to think what Harry does discover and tells us as the audience that we couldn't have figured out without him.
I don't even think he's supposed to be investigating. Again, your job was to come here for insurance fraud, and then this woman maybe wanted you to find out who killed this other guy to protect her husband, who is now dead. Nobody's talking about money for him to stay around, but he's like, basically, we're supposed to believe that there's romantic chemistry here, and ugh.
Well, there's that. Valentin does try to pay Harry off, and Harry, being a good detective, knows that there's something suspicious about that, and Dorothea does want him to stay around, both because we found out she didn't marry for love, she doesn't love Swan, she married him out of obligation because her life was saved by him years before.
And he wanted to marry a 12-year-old? I'll leave it at that.
It is LA. And he does have a lot in common with Nyx, you know? He's a shade lighter than Nyx. But Dorothea wants him around to protect her, to find out who caused her husband's death now. And yeah, they fall in love, or at least lust, sex.
Can you please at least give me that this is a very corny, undeserved scene that should have been cut?
The sex scene?
Yes.
I think it's kind of hot.
Because you like Scott Bakula's back tattoo?
Actually, I kid you not.
You're not going to get this tattoo, are you, Arnie? Come on, don't tell us that.
Don't be surprised if you find this inked on me someday.
Why?
Oh, no.
Why?
Oh, no. You need an intervention.
Yeah, this is really, you gotta, you'll forget it. What makes me happy is you're just in it for the moment, but in a month, it'll be something else.
I just got my X-Men First Class tattoo.
Yeah, okay. Well, that took only, what, about 5-6 years?
Yeah, so it's 6 or 7 years, you will find the Bakula tattoo on me.
And this obviously is tipping at, again, you say that he's not connected to the occult, but this is obviously some sign of something. Owl Cave, maybe he visits or something. What, I mean, you can't tell me he doesn't have a connection to the supernatural. They're just not telling us. They haven't figured it out. Clive hasn't written it.
What connection?
What is this back tattoo if not a connection to something supernatural?
No, he has protections. He has things that will warn him of impending doom, but he can't cast spells. It just is a protective.
But why would you get that if you didn't totally get into magic and believe in it?
He believes. He's a reluctant believer, but after being called into it time and time and time again...
The more you're describing this character, the more I see Bakula wrong for this. This should be played in an entirely different way if that's the way I'm supposed to be interpreting this. Wow.
But here comes the scene that I've always had the most problem with, and it's not the sex scene. It's the special effects after the sex scene where some fire lawnmower man...
The origami ghost?
Origami demon stalks the house. It did take me my third viewing to realize this is Swan.
Yeah, well, this is what I mean about cutting this scene. I mean, yes, all of this. The only reason the sex scene is here is so that he can be there shirtless when it's Philip, it's Swan, hearing from Valentin that his wife is messing around and trying to scare the guy with an actual magical phantom that his wife dispels by touching.
Look, origami ain't scary. Oh, is he going to turn into a crane and you pull the tail and the wings are going to flap?
I know that they were trying to push the level of effects at the time, but this was pretty bad when the best you can do is flashing yellow flashlights at Scott Bakula while doing a POV cam for the majority of it. They did think need to leave this in because later on, Swan's going to pull this fire effect out at a critical moment to burn Butterfield, but here... This was a bit confusing to me, and it does help to show, though, that Valentin is the person most in Swan's confidence. It's why Valentin would know where the bodies are buried.
Yeah, it's why Butterfield should have just gone to him. There was a blonde, by the way. Remember, there was another woman that went was there in the prologue. It's just mentioned in passing that he already killed her.
Why do that? That is dropped ball.
Because Barker can't write this screenplay.
In no cut does she ever become important.
Yes, again, why cast something you don't need? These are things you learn in screenwriting 101. It's very common. You duplicate. You have multiple characters when you only need one. And you think economically about, well, how do I use the best of what I have? Here, characters come and go. Exactly. Who was that who magician that drops out in the middle? Who was the insurance fraud guy that drops out at the beginning? I mean, none of this matters.
You see this when they adapt novels all the time, where they'll take three characters and just make it one in the film. I mean, yeah, this is common to do. It's a visual medium, and you don't get to set the pace like you do when you're reading. So you got to be able to keep up. So maybe I am making that MTV argument a little bit. But it's Clive's fault here for making so many characters when so few of them actually matter.
Yeah, so I thought that Philip was just basically trying to hide out until Butterfield can be stopped. Why not have somebody, why not hire Harry to do that? Why make it instead that he wants to drop a car on him when he finds him in the turtle lair?
Okay, Swan is a ultimate coward, is what we're going to find out. He doesn't want to do anything but hide. He faked his own death because he doesn't want to fight. He thinks the only way for him and Dorothea, he says, to be safe is if Butterfield thinks he's already dead. And when Harry discovers him looking like Joss Whedon with the fake beard at his own funeral, then he wants to kill Harry, A, for sleeping with his wife, and B, to keep his secret that he's not really dead.
Yeah, and coming to the funeral in a disguise is really stupid.
Could you really resist the chance to go to your own funeral and see who cries hardest? I'd have to be there.
Yeah, go as a magical origami thing. I mean, just, you know, you don't have to go in there with the fake mustache and hat. That makes you stand out. I mean, everyone sees him, and, you know, that's why Harry can follow him back. He lives under a bridge, and he's just going to live there forever?
I think just until the whole Nyx thing blows over.
Well, Nyx is going to destroy the world. How's that going to blow over? Is he going to float in space because there's no Earth or something? This makes no sense to hide when someone wants to destroy everything.
I don't think he's thinking it through. He's thinking, if I hide, I'll be safe. It's the kid pulling the covers up over his head so the monster can't see him.
But why is he like this when he stood up to Nyx before and he saved Dorothea? He rushed in with a gun, and what's changed?
Why isn't he guarding the body at least? Why doesn't he have Nyx in this little lair with him?
There's no answers. That says it all.
Because, you know, that would make too much sense, and it doesn't suit the plot contrivance that Butterfield is going to come for the valet and beat it out of him.
Well, also, 13 years ago, Swan wasn't rich enough to do much except bury Nick's in some random desert spot. He didn't have the money to get a place under the bridge or someplace in a mausoleum to hide a body.
You think it takes money to live under this bridge?
He's a super rich magician. Like, he's got to have some cash squirreled away.
Well, now he is. He wasn't 13 years ago.
Okay, go dig the body back up and put it in a cement tomb that can't be dug up or something.
Yeah, lots of people work for him. I'm sure he could have these arrangements made.
You guys are nitpicking areas that I would never even think of nitpicking.
No, this is not nitpicking. These are glaringly huge holes.
We're now nitpicking. This is what we do. And usually, you have no problem with it when it's a movie that you haven't signed on. But for some reason, you are just giving a pass 100 different ways to Sunday for this thing that, again, I'm going to agree with you. It has a cool vibe. I like what it's trying to do. It's doing it very badly.
I'm not saying it's a perfect film. I agree with some of the flaws, but that the fact that he didn't go back to dig up this body he killed 8 years ago and bury it again is not one of them.
If this is good versus evil and he defeated the evil magic man, make sure that he doesn't get resurrected. Like, you got a responsibility there. Look, Harry's a bad hero. Swan's a bad hero because they don't do heroic things. They're lazy.
He's really that afraid of Butterfield? This is the worst nightmare?
You see those shiny pants Butterfield wears?
That is ridiculous. He's got people. Hire someone and put a hit on him. Use magic and kill him. I will not accept that he's going to hide under a bridge when he finds out that the people that he went with into the cult 12 years ago are dropping at the hands of Butterfield. And the only reason that's happening is because Butterfield's trying to find out where the body is.
And yes, Valentin does know, which they find out when they kill the housekeeper we've never seen before.
God.
Yeah, even though he wasn't part of the SWAT team at the beginning that saved Dorothea, somehow he's the one that knows where the body is.
Wouldn't it have made a little bit more sense? Well, no, I guess it wouldn't. I was going to say, if instead of the blonde who never comes back and was killed before the movie started, if it was Valentin, but no, because then Swan would know we have to hide Valentin as well, because he thinks Butterfield is only going to come for those four who attacked.
Valentin doesn't need to know. He wasn't there at the time, so he told him. At one point, he wanted him to know, and now it's a liability.
And Butterfield resurrects Nyx, and here's a really nifty revisiting of the Frank resurrection. Instead of having the organs reform outside, we're gonna like do inner body cam and see the organs come back together. I like the shot.
And so it's going to be for Harry to tell him, hey, let's stop this. Let's go get the body, except we're too late. Oh, let's go to the cultist. Oh, wait, we're too late.
Not really too late. I want to point out, this is where Harry is really important. Because if Harry hadn't pushed Swan, if Harry hadn't told Swan, you really need to get some balls, the world would end. Harry saved the world.
I don't know if that's true. I think that Dorothea didn't need to be told where to shoot Nyx in the head.
Dorothea would never have escaped captivity if Swan and Harry hadn't shown up to release her and cause chaos.
You don't think Swan would have shown up to save his wife?
No, I do not. He would have sat in that cave and let her die.
Well, then he's a shitty character and I don't care. I care less about him now.
He's not your hero. Harry is your hero.
Nah, Harry's not the hero either.
Yeah, you're wanting him to be the bad husband so you can feel better that D'Amour gets her in the end. But I don't know. Where did the gun come from? Because she ultimately will be the one to kill the villain.
Harry had it.
Yeah, it's Harry's
okay,
gun.
So that's it.
He just never shoots it. He just holds it.
Harry delivers the gun that she will use to shoot him, and he will point to his forehead because she wouldn't know that that would kill him otherwise.
Well, he does have that from beyond pineal gland, third eye, phallic thing poking out of his head going on.
Yeah, that's why I'm saying we don't need Harry at all in this climax. We don't need Harry in this. I just want to say the movie that I would enjoy would be, this is Clive's theme, right? When we get Nyx back and we're resurrecting him, we're getting to the character that, I mean, he's always writing about, the fallen Messiah. He's kind of like Jesus. And there's even this talk about, well, did Jesus use magic? I mean, that was said in the Magic Castle. He's fascinated by the idea of men that have the potential to be gods and then for whatever reason choose pleasure or choose themselves. I think that Nyx is a very interesting character, finding out why he chose evil, finding out why he wants to burn the world when he could have used this power in other ways. That's the story, man. That is what Clive cares about. And yet, that's not what this movie is delivering at all.
That story isn't in here, and that is a big part of my problem. Again, going back all the way to the beginning with that cult. Why are they hanging out with him? Why is he leading this cult? What is the appeal of juggling fire when you can do any kind of magic you want? What is his end goal?
His end goal is nihilism.
But why? Why would you choose that because you know magic?
Oh, it's even worse than that. There's this scene where at some point he's going to knock around Swan and say, I can't believe you care about this woman. She's just a bunch of flesh. And then later he's going to be like, hey, after I destroy the world, we're going to hang out and get married and, you know, sit on the couch and eat cheese puffs. Wait a minute.
No, what he wants is, I mean, he's seeking a friend for the end of the world to steal that movie title. But once they've killed everybody else, he's going to kill Swan, too. I mean, he just has to. And he says that. He says, you know, when this is all over, I have to kill you, too. It's my mission.
Yeah, but my point is, Dorothy is a distraction between his relationship with Swan for half of this climax. And then all of a sudden, oh, yeah, that's why I had her chained up when she was 12. She's my bride. And after I destroy the world, this flesh, this particular flesh matters, but none of the other flesh matters.
No, that flesh never mattered to Nyx.
Then why is he trying to save her?
Nyx is never trying to save her.
Yes, he is. Watch the climax again. He is saying that I will have you after the end of the world. That is why she was tied up and waiting for him back in 1982.
No, he's saying that to Swan. He'll have Swan at the end of the world, not Dorothea.
In a different scene, he said that, but I guarantee you, at one point, she is his bride.
No.
Yes.
I've seen this movie like two dozen
times. Then
you
need to see it again and see that scene to see how infuriating it is.
I think you've misread his words.
That could be. I will not deny that this movie is full of all kinds of unclear motivation.
And truthfully, when I saw this in theaters and I saw him come back and kill his own cultists, I mean, it's a cool special effect, the way he makes the earth sink and how they go from revelry in the rain to dead. But I'm like, what the fuck is he doing? It makes more sense when I see this cut that they weren't worthy, Butterfield, and really only Swan was worthy.
Not worthy? What more MTV could that be? That's Wayne's World's line. And this was also confusing. He creates a storm cloud that has water falling. We see the electrical sparks. I think, oh, they're going to fry.
Yes.
But it actually makes the ground muddy and they sink.
Which, again, I do agree with Arnie. It is kind of a cool effect, but I don't get this. Why didn't he kill his followers 13 years ago at the beginning of this film? Why kill them all now?
If we knew what Nyx was doing, and we, more importantly, cared about it. Again, I think you could write this movie so that, to me, he's the most relatable character. He has powers. It's kind of like the frustration of an intellectual. He's mad at the world for not understanding that flesh is impermanent. He keeps wanting people to see that skin rots, that caring about others and all, it doesn't matter, that what really matters is magic, real magic. And no one will believe that. No one can see that. And so he is just trying to make the world understand that his values are more important than materialism. You know, that was also the Hellraiser thing. It was kind of the plot of Deader, now that I think about it.
I just think that you'd want a less scuzzy, creepy, dirty-looking messiah. It used to really repulse me about this film, is that this was the cult leader. He had so little charisma. I had no idea this was an actor that at the same time I was loving on Seinfeld playing Krueger.
Yeah, and then he'd be in RoboCop 3.
Yeah. I had no clue it was this actor. He just, I lose him in his roles. But this final climax is a little bit confusing to me when his face starts sprouting.
I call it the potato time lapse. You know, like how potatoes, if you don't eat that yes. potato at a certain point, the roots start sprouting out there. This feels like we need some special effects in this because this is a horror movie and you haven't had enough of that.
It's kind of cool. I do like that Harry and Swan have to work together to stop him. Swan's body is broken. He's dying, but he has enough in him for one last effect. He's going to levitate Harry, and Harry's going to be the hands, and Swan's going to be the power.
Yeah, what teamwork. Good job. You really pushed him down the hole real good.
Yeah, I do love the line. It's like, lift me up like you did the car.
Yeah, I don't get why that needs to happen flying.
It's a real Fantastic Four moment where all their powers come together to defeat the forces of evil.
And he decides, you know, even though he's thrown into the center of the earth, he can do one more Sam Raimi trick and send something up to blow up the house, and thus killing the husband so that Harry can run off with the wife.
I'm pretty sure Swan was dying anyway from the wounds inflicted by Nyx. Here we just get a CGI flesh ripping because, hey, Clive Barker likes to remove your skin.
Yeah, for the Hellraiser fans that were like, what is this slow-paced movie that doesn't have any gore? This was overcompensation here at the end. They're just throwing a lot of special effects right here at the end to try and give you a big bang as you go out.
The ending, though, here the movie just ends. I mean, are Harry and Dorothea together? Is Harry going back to New York? Is he ever going to follow up on that insurance fraud? We're going to hear some lines from throughout the film as an encore, I guess. I mean, I don't know why they pick the lines they do. I mean, it's Nyx's voice from beyond the grave saying what he said before.
Flesh is a trap and magic sets us free. Again, this was the story of Nyx and him trying to make the point that people are materialistic when they should be focused on magic or spiritualism. That would have been more relevant. I mean, if this were a story about a detective, you would have him close out, you know, that's what detectives do, the voiceover, you know, that classic Sam Spade, wrap it all up. But this has not been Bakula's movie. He has just been a bystander in all.
All right, well, let's have the depressing ending. Jacob Stewart, do you recommend Lord of Illusions? Jacob.
What's the line in this movie? There's a fine line between light and dark. For me, there is a fine line between, like Stewart said, that supernatural noir. I love Hellblazer, which is the Constantine comic. There's a fine line between that and Renfair bullshit. And unfortunately, I feel like this movie, because there's so little characterization, Clive Barker, he loves this magic world with monsters and demons and all that. It's not enough for me. I got to care about these people, their stories. They need to make sense. I'm not going to be fascinated by David Copperfield making the Statue of Liberty disappear. That was cool when I was like 7. I need more, though, in a 2-hour movie. That's not here. The characters that play little to no role in their journey, the writing's just full of huge plot holes. You don't even need magic to make the Statue of Liberty disappear. Just throw it through one of these plot holes. Yeah, pretty solid not recommend for me.
Stuart.
Actually, this walks the thin line between Green and Red Arrow. Believe it or not, despite all my complaints, I love the genre so much, I still wanted to give this a pass. I'm like, this is a crap movie. But Constantine...
Don't give in to the dark side.
Constantine was a crap movie, but there were enough things about it. You know what? I recommended Doctor Strange the TV movie for just this reason. If you can combine magic, the occult, detective, demons, all of that, I'm an easy lay. I can go with this very, very... I was rooting for this movie, and it just kept hitting me in the face with how unimportant the detective was. Ultimately, the problem is Clive. He's getting worse. Each of his films is worse than the next, the more money and power he is given. I am glad he stopped because, yeah, the pacing of this is awful. The plotting of this is awful. The acting in this is awful. You know, maybe I owe Ashley Lawrence an apology.
Ooh.
Maybe she's a great actress and he just directs all his actors like Famke Johnson and Scott Bakula here to be flat and uninteresting and not carry the movie. But Clive sucks as a director, and this is the problem. Ultimately, if someone else had been on board, they would have been able to make the movie with even these problems. Even this script, I'm sure another director could have focused on the details and kept the plotting going in a way that I could go, yeah, sure, it was fun. This movie was not fun. It was boring, and that's at Barker's feet.
Whew, you guys are harsh on this one. I know this film has problems. There's some slight pacing problems, but I do feel each 30 minutes forms its own portion of the story pretty effectively. I do think the movie keeps moving. I know that the prologue, while exciting to watch, does undermine a lot of the story because we are smarter than Harry and we know more than he's ever told. He should have been told that, and there should have been even more of a mystery somehow. Maybe we don't know Butterfield is the man behind it and we just know somebody's trying to resurrect Nyx, something like that. And maybe a better question than where's the body? Maybe where's a magical device also needed for the body or something, or needs to steal Swan's magic to resurrect the body. I get that. And I'll agree with you that some of the acting here is bad. Famke Janssen never hits a note that makes me understand Harry's love for her.
Mm-mm.
I find Philip Swan, when he becomes a super coward at the end, I'm like, why didn't we see that earlier? I do feel Kevin O'Connor also gives an uneven and somewhat flat performance, and I would lay that at Clive's feet. I don't think he gave his actors the right motivation and the right direction there. Valentin isn't so good either. You're not going to get me to say anything bad against Bakula. Bakula does what Bakula does, and I like what Bakula does. I like him as a PI. I would like to see him do more of this. I might even check out that NCIS show. I honestly, till this recording, didn't know he was on one. And I do like Nyx as the cult leader, and I like his cultists. I like his cultists so much. Each of them has such personality. There's one that looks like Chris Kattan from Saturday Night Live, although, I mean, Chris Kattan was probably in grade school, but it looks just like Chris Kattan. And there's the guy with the glasses and the fat chick. I just love these cult members and how loyal they are. And, I mean, these people give better performances than a lot of the leads in their complete devotion to Nyx and their shock betrayal and murdering their families. I love that one of them is a mailman too. That makes me happy that he, you know, goes postal. But there's a lot of fun to be had here in this noir magic mashup. I really do believe it. I've seen this film multiple times. I watched both cuts for this review, and watching a movie twice is really where I can say if I like it or not. And I'll tell you, when I watched the theatrical cut, I walked away and went, that movie was not as good as I remembered. It's a recommend, but, you know, it's a weaker recommend. I put it in Letterboxd as 3 stars. When I watched this cut, I gave it 4. I do think this movie has flaws. It's not perfect. It's not a 5-star film, but it is well worth your time and watch. And it's certainly the best Harry D'Amore adventure I've ever read. I have read all of the Prince's stories and none are this good.
Let me ask you, of the 3 Clive Barker films, where would it rank?
Certainly below Hellraiser. Hellraiser's his first and his best.
Okay. You know what? I would be up for a remake. I would be up for a Harry D'Amore TV series. I want a supernatural detective show. Somebody do that. That's great. Even Bakula. That's great. Tailor it to his talents. We'll do that. This movie didn't serve him. Again, I'm putting all of it at Barker's feet.
There was going to be a sequel. This movie did okay in theaters. It did very well on video. And there was going to be a sequel. It was going to be called Vipex. I don't know what that is. V-I-P-E-X. It was not going to be written or directed by Barker, only produced. Again, he said that with Hellraiser. He never wanted to make a part 2. And his statement at the time was a lot of people could have directed Lord of Illusions. It didn't have to be him.
I'll say.
But only one writer could write the books he was doing at that time, which were Sacramenting, Galilee. And he also did have other stuff going on. There was supposed to be a $16 million BBC Weaveworld miniseries and a Thief of Always movie produced by Kathleen Kennedy and Frank Marshall.
Weaveworld is where I stopped reading him. I was just like, they're in a carpet. I can't do it.
I couldn't get into it. Yeah, I couldn't get like 100 pages of that thing. That was rough. It's like everything's Hellraiser. I'm going to open a robe. I'm going to open a carpet. It's like he writes fantasy. He stopped writing horror and I stopped reading fantasy. So yeah. And then they were talking around the early 2000s, a Lord of Illusions TV series. I would really, really have gone for that. I think Bakula would have done it if he hadn't been doing Enterprise at the time. And I think Harry D'Amore, especially if you did a TV series like it's done today on HBO or something, maybe True Blood it where every season is a different mystery or something, I would love that. I really would. I think D'Amore is his best character. I like his attitude. I like his lines. I've never found him in the perfect story for him. And Barker continues to tease directing. I did mention the Hellraiser reboot. It was announced in 2004, so it never happened, but it was announced he was going to direct the Tortured Souls movie based off those toys from McFarlane. It was going to be written by the screenwriter who wrote the Man-Thing movie. Just none of that sounding good to me.
You say Clive Barker directing, and it's never sounding good. I mean, again, he even seems to know it. The fact that he stopped to me, indicates that he understands this isn't his bag.
Yeah, I think he receives a lot of criticism for his work. I mean, from the studios for whom he works, who he feels markets it badly, the test audiences who force him to make cuts, the MPAA who force him to make further cuts. When he writes a book, he writes a book. He gives it to a publisher. They print it. So I think he found his bliss at home painting his paintings and writing his books. Will he ever direct again? I tend not to think so. He has health problems. He called it an expensive hobby. He's not as young as he used to be. I think he may be out of it. I mean, bringing him back out now, I don't understand why you would.
Yeah. Adapt more of his stories, sure. But have more Clive Barker-directed movies, I don't think that's good for anyone.
Well, we'll discuss all the rest of his movies, and if I felt like even his stories were worth adapting when we go through them in the timeline of the Hellraiser series. But until then, patrons, thank you for your donation and your pledge. We hope you've enjoyed this kind of Easter egg add-on for our gold donation series, and we'll tell you next month's patron film gonna be Fred Savage in The Wizard?
Yeah, let's just go ahead and spoil it for them. I mean, you're a patron. You deserve to be on a little secret. We are kicking off a big series in January based on video games. And so this is our kickoff. It's not really a video game movie, but it is a Nintendo commercial.
Oh, it is such a great commercial when that came out.
Yeah, I think it's what, the Power Glove? Was that the thing?
Super Mario Brothers 3 is the big reveal, but yeah, there's a pretty cool Power Glove commercial.
It's like Rayman with a Nintendo. I never actually did see it, but my understanding is that's what it is.
It is indeed like that. Two brothers on the road, one a little mentally challenged, only instead of blackjack, he's good at games.
Okay, well, you've been good to us, so we're going to reward you with The Wizard come January. And then, yeah, don't tell anyone, but shortly thereafter, we will be on the main feed covering movies based on video games, which include the classics, Super Mario Brothers, Mortal Kombat, and yes, theatrical things like the new Tomb Raider series and Rampage, Ready Player One, even Wreck-It Ralph at the end of the year.
And we're going to start. The first one on the main feed is actually a good movie, I'll tell you. The King of Kong, a documentary about the best arcaders in the world.
Yeah, we're going to try to follow the origin of the game, start with the most rudimentary game, so that would be Donkey Kong and all those coin-ops, and then work our way up to, well, I think we'll, by the time we finish it, that Minecraft movie will be out, and God help us Angry Birds, too.
Ooh, Angry Birds.
You mean there's no Pong movie yet?
Not yet.
Isn't that Balls of Fury, ping pong?
Oh, God. It took me a second to remember that one.
It took me one, too, yeah.
Yes, you donated to the grave, so we'll give you some podcasts from the grave in return. So thank you for joining us this month. Happy New Year. A lot of podcasts on the main feed and the gold feed between now and then. Jacob Stewart, thank you for joining me. And the fire said to me, hush.
I finished with the world. We were going to keep each other company in the dark. But I'm on my own. We're all on our own. The grave is lonely. The living is worse.
Thank you to all the listeners who have backed us through our Podbean crowdfunding campaign. And we hope you've enjoyed this special bonus movie review podcast.
Are you a professional, or did you just come here to watch the shows?
Bit of both.
Now Playing relies on support from listeners like you to keep going. So thanks to you all.
Too much money, too much fame.
Where do I sign up?
You've heard the movie review, but now go to booksandnachos.com to hear Arnie tear through the flesh of Clive Barker's The Last Illusion, as well as the Hellraiser books, The Hellbound Heart, The Scarlet Gospels, and more.
I've got so much power to give you. All you have to do is beg. You don't think that I've got it to give? You're wrong!
Now that you've heard this review, head to the Now Playing Podcast forums and share your thoughts on this movie. The link to our forums is at nowplayingpodcast.com.
I'd love to hang with you guys for a little while.
Now Playing is produced and edited by Arnie Carvalho.
full house. Standing ovation. I tell them it's magic.
They believe you.
Now playing credit narration by Brock.
Do not speak another word to this man if you wish to keep my company.
The film, Lord of Illusions, and all audio clips and music used are the property of their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. This podcast has not been prepared, approved, or licensed by any entity that created or produced this film. Now Playing is an independent movie review podcast with no affiliation with any company involved in the publishing, creating, or distribution of that movie.
I believe that we walk a narrow path between
heaven and hell,
divinity and trickery.
The opinions expressed on Now Playing are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the opinion of Venganza Media Incorporated.
See, that's his best trick. No illusions, just the truth. Are you ready for that?
Now Playing is a Venganza Media production, copyright 2017, all rights reserved, and no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated.
Pleasure's a trap, that's what he used to say. Pleasure's a trap. And magic sets us free.
I think even in Quantum Leap, where he was playing a black woman, it was Scott Bakula.
Blackula?
It was Scott Blackula. It was Scott Bakula.
What was his character's name in Quantum Leap?
I don't even know. He's just always Scott Bakula to me, because his name rhymes with Dracula, so it's kind of cool.